Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to New Books in the American West, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. My name is Dan Moran. I am thrilled to be here today with Ted Conover, author of Cheap Land, Colorado, Off-Gridders at America's Edge, just published in November of 22 by Knopf. Ted Conover is a professor at and the former director of New York University's Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute. His work has appeared in The Atlantic, The New York Times Magazine, The New Yorker, Harper's, and National Geographic. In 2000, he won the National Book Critics Circle Award for New Jack, Guarding Sing Sing, which was also a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Welcome, Ted.
Thanks a lot, Dan.
So let's talk about where in Colorado this book takes place, and then we'll actually get into the reasons for your trip out there and what you found, because I imagine that, like many people, the setting of the book is not what they might anticipate when they see a book with Colorado in the title.
Fair enough. It is, it's on the prairie in Colorado. The mountains are visible from there, but it's not a mountain place except around the edges. The San Luis Valley, which is my location for this book, is in south central Colorado. And if you drove without stopping from Denver, you might get there in 4 hours, though it might take you a little longer. The valley is the size of New Jersey, and it extends all the way into New Mexico. The southern end of it is Taos, but most of it is in Colorado, and most of it is this prairie, private land that you might think is some sort of federal land because so much beautiful space in Colorado belongs to the government, but it's private, most of it, and that is kind of why there are so many little lots there that turns out people are able to live on.
Okay, so let's turn to like the actual book and like what you did and who the people you met. So in some ways, I was your ideal reader because this was not the book I thought I would be reading. I was wonderfully sucker punched by this book. I thought it was going to be that you were going to be this modern day Thoreau who goes out to the West, he goes out to the flats, you know, he finds his own way and kind of reports back to the rest of us and tells us how to live our lives. And there's a little bit of that in the book, but your book is really filled with these engaging, rough stories about people in all kinds of trouble. And many of them are not there for the beauty of the flats or the beauty of the natural world, right? You say, here's a quote from your book, "The San Luis Valley with its extra cheap land was a sort of mecca for these off-gridders." So what kind of off-gridders are we talking about here? Like what kind of people did you find move out to the San Luis Valley?
So that's a good question, because there's a whole spectrum of off-gridders. You know, at the more expensive end, there's people who can afford earthships, which I'm sure some of your listeners will know about. These are sort of high-tech green constructions that incorporate, you know, tires and bottles and have advanced systems for recycling water. But this is way at the bottom end of the scale in terms of expense. The people who are drawn to the valley usually have very little money. This is some of the cheapest land you can get in the United States. And I guess there's a push and a pull involved. Some are looking for a, you know, a new start. Actually, a lot, I'd say, are looking for a new start. But for 100 or 1,000 different reasons, it might be the two women who left their husbands in Oklahoma to start a new life with each other and were some of the first people I met out there. Or the person who introduced me to them was named Matt Little. And Matt came from West Virginia and some tours in the military in Iraq and Afghanistan. And he'd lost his wife. His house had burned down. And he thought, gosh, if I could start anywhere, I would want to start, I think, in Colorado. And that brought him. You find people who you think might have trouble fitting in the mainstream world. And you find people, yeah, who feel like exiles in a lot of ways, who just, for various reasons, have sort of opted out of the mainstream, or maybe they've been pushed.
Yeah. So there is a little bit of that John Denver, the lyrics to Rocky Mountain High in there, like getting away from, you know, the rest of the world. And if I could start over anywhere, it would be in Colorado.
There's definitely an optimism to it. And it is undeniably beautiful, even if it's not right next to the mountains. It's, you know, the prairie, to my eye, is incredibly beautiful. And the skies there are captivating and dramatic. There's always something going on. The weather, you know, is just interesting all the time. But it's an unpleasant place to live when it gets cold, or when it's windy, which is much of the year. It's a rough place to be. And lots of people I lived with who were my age were often thinking, gosh, I wish I could go somewhere warmer in the winter. And, you know, some figure out a way to go to Arizona or New Mexico or Mexico itself sometimes. But yeah, it's a wide variety of people who share, I'd say, a certain disaffection with mainstream life.
Yeah. Okay. Now, you mentioned Matt Little, who comes up in the book a lot before, and the title comes from a phrase that Matt Little Googled. He Googled the phrase Cheapland, Colorado. And it's funny, I looked on Zillow this morning and I was like, yeah, like there's plenty of lots for, I'm not about to do this. The book's already been written and you cornered this market. So, you know, there are plenty of lots available though for $5,000 or $6,000. I mean, I'm just going through them and it was funny. I'm like, oh yeah, that's Alamosa. Like all the places mentioned in the book. Right. But I want to ask you about the subtitle. The subtitle is Off-Gridders at America's Edge. Now, you talk about this edge in the book, and what's fascinating is that you don't mean, obviously, the geographic edge, like the coast. Like, what do you mean by the edge? The edge of what?
I guess I'm thinking about marginal, the margins. Like, the margins of the page of a book are the place where there's no words. They're outside of the main action or even outside of our consideration, right? These are people who are often probably not counted on the census. They're not thought of by many politicians. And often that is how they want it. They, in many cases, have sort of checked out of society in some way. A number of them, I'd say you could call them hermits. They're just not interested in interaction very often. But there are exceptions to that. There are people who, though they might live 2 miles from their next neighbor, they're sending messages on their, you know, on the one bar of cellular signal they have on their cell phone. They're messaging their neighbors. They're talking about the mountain lion or the sunset or the problem with the road or the bridge. There's just, but yeah, you definitely feel you are out of the mainstream there. And part of that is encountering people with, you know, what struck me as off the wall ideas about how soon society will be coming to an end, or the treachery of politicians, especially those in blue states or in you know, people in blue states generally. I think there's a real suspicion of journalists and of professors, which obviously presented a particular challenge to me.
Yeah. So let's talk about this. So you're known, you're established as somebody that practices what's called immersion journalism. And you even have a book called by that name about immersion journalism. So in this book, in Cheapland, Colorado, you talk about your desire to become a landowner here. And here's a quote by you from the book. You say, "I could interview 100 landowners, but it seemed to me I'd understand them more if I had skin in the game." So can you talk, because more than once when I was reading, you know, I put the book down on my lap for a second. I say, I wonder what it was like at what moment this guy said, "You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go out there and I'm actually going to buy one of these things." And because it struck me as, yes, this could be a great long Atlantic piece or a great long piece for the New Yorker. But I laughed when I read that out loud. You're like, you know what? I should have some skin in the game. So can you talk about that moment and how you ended up off the grid?
So I went to learn about the people who live out there and try to figure out who they are and why they made that choice. And my interest was piqued by just seeing some similar settlements in a similar part of Colorado called South Park, which is the sort of namesake of the cartoon series that, you know, has all these colorful and misfit people in it. There's a real South Park, and huge parts of it are empty except for a giant grid of dirt roads that was created in the 70s by real estate speculators and a handful of remote little homesteads, you know. Half of them are trailers that you're not sure could actually move again. And there's wooden lean-tos, there's sheds, there's tough sheds. There's people sometimes living in their vehicles. There's a whole radio segment I heard while I was researching my book about a man who lives in the ground in South Park. While he's building his house, he's sort of dug a hole and put a roof over it. And so these are really basic structures. And I got interested the more I saw of them, the more I was surprised, because I grew up in Colorado and this was not the Colorado I knew. You know, this, I write that it reminded me of Appalachia without the trees. And I know lots of Appalachia is very beautiful and not poverty stricken, but I'm talking about the rough, you know, the people off grid in very poor places. And so I got interested to know who they are, but also and this is something I find myself doing. I want to know in a more personal way what it's like to be there. And partly this is maybe a background in anthropology, which I studied as an undergrad, but this idea that if you're participating in people's lives, you're going to know more than if you're just interviewing, right? Like if you are sharing those conditions, if you share food or, you know, whatever it is, if you'll start connecting with them in a different way. And I've stuck with this approach just because, A, I learned so much. When you have your own land and you're trying to figure out how to stay warm and you're worried, like the very first night, you might remember this, I could not open, I ran out of fuel, I almost froze to death. I had a big sleeping bag that, thank goodness, kept me warm. But in the morning, everything was frozen, including my toothbrush, which I tried to use. And then I tried to open the door to get outside, and the frost inside had frozen the door shut. And this isn't something I would know. The panic and the sort of self-doubt, like, you know, here I'm supposedly an educated person, but I'm clearly way out of my depth. Like, I don't really know how to manage this. And so my approach is make this clear to the people I want to get to know. They know what I want to know. How do you stay warm? How do you how do you live out here? And I take that approach. I make them my teachers to the degree I can. I'm upfront that I am from New York. I live there now. And no, I did not vote for Donald Trump because he does not seem to think much of journalists like me. But there's lots to talk about, you know, including politics, but also not politics. And I came with the idea that I could have a conversation even with people I might disagree with in certain ways. And so, yeah, the idea of immersion is that I will stay long enough and take part in that kind of life long enough that I'll have a deeper understanding. And I'll never know 100%, right? Because I can leave. I can go home. If I freeze my toes, I can drive into town and use a credit card to get a hotel room. So I will never understand a lot of important things about desperation or addiction or loneliness that my neighbors know very well. But I'll get closer to it than if I had never tried.
Yeah, that's great. Somebody, when I was reading, asked me, someone said, what's it like? And I go, it's like reading Orwell. I thought it was like The Road to Wigan Pier or Down in Paris in London. So
well, that's a great compliment. He's one of my heroes.
Yeah, certainly.
Yeah.
Yeah, Mr. Immersion himself, right? So let's talk about some of the people you met when you were out there. Let's talk about the family that you live next to and became close to, the Grubers. Like, so tell our listeners, you know, who are the Grubers and what was your living space like? You mentioned how that great scene where you can't use a toothbrush, you almost freeze to death. There's also the scene that made me laugh is when you go out there and you think, is this going to flip over? Is the wind about to flip this thing over? Like, how do we? So, but the Grubers kind of helped you out a lot and they kind of taught you the ropes, right?
Well, exactly. Before I ever bought my own place, I thought, I just want to rent. And I thought, somebody's got a room and needs a tenant. And come to find that that's almost never the case. Most people live in a small dwelling and they don't really want a tenant. And I was told by people at La Puente, the group I volunteered with, who do a rural outreach program that I started working for in order to get out there, I was told, you know, you might not really want to live with everybody you meet out there. And but when I said, well, do you have any ideas for somebody who might rent me a space for a trailer if I bought my own trailer, right? Could I perhaps move it onto somebody's land for a while? And that's how I met the Grubers. It's a mom and dad from Wyoming. They have five daughters. The youngest had just been born when I got there. The oldest was, I think, 12. She's now 17, about to turn 18. And Matt Little took me out to meet them, and they seemed like nice people. I think I must have looked to them like a man from the moon, like because I did not fit in, especially at the beginning. But I figure, you know, I'm just going to try to be myself. I'm going to be friendly. I'm going to see if I can help them, because that's the other thing. There's a lot of need. And La Puente, this social service group based in Alamosa, Colorado, started out running a homeless shelter. They were co-founded by a nun and some community activists. And they discovered that as people were trying to live out on the flats, on the prairie, off grid, they would get super cold this time of year and become homeless and end up in the shelter. And they wanted to stop that. So part of the outreach is offering people firewood, coats, boxes of food from the food bank. Do you need a prescription picked up? Is there anything else I can do? And so I try to, you know, help the Grubers by bringing them some of that stuff. And they were initially super self-conscious about their living conditions, which are, you know, not exactly tidy, because it's hard if you're living out in this windblown, dusty place, and you have dogs coming in and out, and you have all these kids. It's hard to keep tidy. And I said, you know, I understand domestic chaos, from raising my own kids. And I, seriously, I am not going to judge you. And so little by little, I would get invited over. And little by little, we got to know each other pretty well. And so the Grubers were my base for the first like two and a half years. And then I bought my own land and moved my trailer onto that.
Yeah, that's it's funny because you talk about, I'll jump ahead a little bit, you talk about La Puente, right? This rural outreach program. And the first scene of the book is you with Matt Little, I believe, going out. And I love how you give the reader the sense that like you knock on the door or you honk the horn first.
Yeah.
And then you just wait. This isn't so even the rural outreach program is not like, you know, Ned Flanders from The Simpsons knocking on your door like, "Hidely ho, neighbor." Like it's a whole different vibe.
Oh, it's a whole different vibe. And you've got to be really cautious and respectful when you approach somebody's homestead, because some of these folks are a little paranoid.
Yeah.
Some of them are worried about theft because they may have some marijuana plants growing, and marijuana, you know, when a plant is big, that could be worth $1,000. And people have dogs, and as Matt Little pointed out to me, if I see an American flag, that's a good sign that there's probably a firearm inside. Mm-hmm. And he said, but even if you don't see that, you don't want to drive right up to the door. You want to stop on the road and you want to beep the horn and hope you'll get a reaction. And then you might get out of the car and just show them, you know, show them you're just a guy. You're not a big guy. You're not a county inspector of some kind. And you have to wear the right colored shirt.
Yeah, so no blue shirts.
Exactly. It had to be maroon or green. And he just had all this great advice, and be patient. And so that was just super helpful to me. And, you know, you don't want to presume this friendliness, hold out your hand, expect them to shake it. You want to keep your distance and get to know somebody slowly.
Yeah, he was kind of like you were Dante and he was Virgil, like guiding you through this world.
So, something to that.
Which is cool because then you guide the reader. So I was kind of like third. I was like, you know, in the back, you two guys were in the front seat of the car and I was in the back seat. So we talked about the Grubers. Let's talk about another person I thought was representative of the men, because you meet so many people in this book, right? But I found Paul really interesting because he's in the beginning and then he goes away for all and he comes back on. Like, you introduce him as charming and funny. And I remember laughing when I read it. And you kind of think as a reader, you know, sitting here in the comfort of my house, I'm like, oh, I talked to Paul for a while. He seems like a cool guy. But then much later in the book, you know, 150 pages later, you start to say he's having this slow emotional breakdown. Mm. So I started to think like, you know, how is Paul representative of some of the people you met out on the flats?
So you meet people with all kinds of challenges, and Paul's challenge is, you know, nervousness around people. He told me he has social anxiety disorder. He gets super nervous in a Walmart. Mm-hmm. He likes having a visitor for a meal or something, but then maybe it's time to go. And, he's got dogs for company. He has five heeler dogs mostly. He calls them the girls. They're all girls. He's very open about how he is and how he's doing. And in fact, when I met him, the first thing he said is, "Hi, I'm Paul. And yes, I'm gay." And I thought, oh, wow. Okay. good to know. Thank you for that. And, you know, he's very endearing that way, and he's funny. On the other hand, he is subject to depression, to getting upset. He's really bothered by the wind. If he were part of this conversation, I think he'd be nodding and saying, "Can't stand that freaking wind." And he posts on about it on Facebook. "It's driving me crazy." And I think it was during a windy time of year when he just – you could just see he was making less sense. He was saying, "This is driving me nuts. It's driving me up the wall." He shows one day that he has broken his own TV. He has tipped over his own refrigerator. He's thrown a toaster out the window. And I tried through La Puente to see if I could get him some counseling, because that's really what he wanted and what he needed. And another neighbor called me one day. She thought he was suicidal and the police had taken him to a clinic. And I told La Puente, this is kind of an emergency. Is there anything we can do? And there was, you know, they knew it's super hard to get free mental health care in this valley. It's a very, there's very skeletal services, really, of any kind, but medical is particularly, it's hard to find people. But we were able to set him up with a weekly session, and I think it really helped him. It wasn't a cure, right? I think his moods continue to fluctuate, but he's managing. And so, yeah, he's actually one of the people I've gotten to know best out there.
Yeah. And his story is one of, like, as a reader, you get some of these small triumphs as the book goes on. You get some scenes that are really heartbreaking, but you also get these, and he was one of those triumphs, it seems, where he's not, you know, everything is not a magic wand, but you got him what he needed. So,
yeah, well, it's one of the things I'm most proud of having done in all the months I volunteered for La Puente was helping Paul. So, you know, as a journalist, you're there to learn, but I think you can do that without compromising your mission of coming to understand and cast light on a way of life. I think it's possible to wear more than one hat at a time if you're transparent about who you are and what you're doing.
Yeah, certainly, certainly. So let's talk about it. Let's shift gears a little. Talk about the theme of freedom, because that's certainly a word people associate with Colorado, right? So there's this romantic notion about freedom, or maybe it's not romantic at all, that comes up in the book. So here's a quote by you about 100 pages in the book. You say that you, quote, love the open country. The emptiness was freedom, but too much of it could be a bad thing. So how so?
Yeah, so there's a couple of aspects in which it can be bad. I think what I was talking about right there was my own feelings of loneliness and solitude. Solitude is something I treasure. I live in New York City.
We all want it, right? We all want. Well, you come home and no one's home, and you get the house to yourself for 2 hours. I could read. I could think. I could do whatever I want. Like we look for it.
It's heaven. It's heaven. but out there on the prairie, it might be heaven for a day or two, but by day three, I need to connect. I need to relate to people. Maybe I need to drive into town. Maybe I need to talk to somebody on the phone. Maybe I need to go to their house. That might be the best thing. And in a way, that was good because it kept me engaged with people, right? Like that was what I was supposed to be doing there, is talking to people, meeting them. But I have a fear, I guess, of being isolated and alone for too long. And so that's one aspect of all that.
Quick question. Did you know that about yourself before you went out there? Or did you think like, oh, I can handle this? I've been in rougher places. And then after a while, you became kind of like Jack Nicholson in The Shining.
So that Jack Nicholson scene, it actually had a lot of meaning earlier in my career as a writer when I was trying to write my very first book, which is called Rolling Nowhere. It's about riding freight trains with railroad tramps. And I was done with the research and I moved up to a cabin owned by my family in Winter Park, Colorado with my dog. And I thought, this is how writers get their books done, right?
You move up to the hotel. That's great. Right. I'll be the caretaker.
Exactly. And it was a terrible mistake because for the same reasons, I got lonely and the dog was not good enough company. And so I knew this about myself, but that was a while ago. And so I kind of had to relearn it and recalculate my own, how to keep myself on a good path. And so, freedom, the freedom of all that space is a wonderful thing, but, there are downsides.
Okay. So it's almost like, me and Bobby McGee, freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose, which is actually a different kind of freedom, right? But you also say later in the book that some people were, this is another quote by you, they're seeking more freedom from the bad deeds of the past or even the freedom to do more bad.
So absolutely. And this is one of the more harsh things I learned out there is that people who I initially liked and assumed were good people revealed themselves to have done some terrible things. And one was a neighbor who, in front of my eyes, paid $25 for a heeler puppy, you know, an Australian cattle dog. They're very popular out there. And my nearest neighbor, Troy, had some for sale. This guy bought one day, and he's a charming, somewhat sophisticated, worldly guy who, it turned out, had a long history of running puppy mills in remote parts of the West, California, Oregon. I think he had legal issues in three or four states at least, where he had done bad things to animals. And I felt naive. I felt I was being too rosy-eyed, optimistic about human nature. And then there was a guy he was friends with who was arrested one day by the sheriff's office, which posted on their Facebook page a mugshot of this 80-year-old man who had fixed up a broken-down cabin. I thought he was so virtuous and just a person to admire. It turns out he was an unregistered sex offender. He had failed to sign up and tell the sheriff he was there. He was at the time he'd established himself as a preacher at a nearby church. And obviously this is a problem, right? But you do meet people out there with open warrants, with felonies that they are. So they are trying to keep out of they want to stay away from authority. They don't want brushes with people in power. And that's part of life out there.
Yeah, it's a different kind of freedom than the naive person who wants to go and look at the beautiful sky every day.
Exactly.
So let's shift gears again. Drugs. So yeah. drugs are all over this book. We have all these people growing weed, which is legal there, but you have a lot of people addicted to opioids. And you quote the sheriff of Alamosa saying that 90% of all the prisoners at the Alamosa jail had an opiate addiction. And there are many stories in the book of these broken families. Like I said, some parts of the book are funny and you trying to navigate your way through it are amusing, but some parts of it are grim, right? You have these families trying to navigate their lives through the desperation of being involved with meth and opiates. So can you talk about the connection between, actually a two-part question, the connection between drugs and life in the Valley, and did any of your experience out there affect your opinions or complicate them about the so-called, war on drugs? Because you don't editorialize, which I think is great about the book. You kind of say, here's what I saw.
Right. I want readers to be able to make up their own minds. But that said, there are some facts that readers need to know. Yeah. And I tell how on the same month that I met the Grubers out on the prairie, 60 Minutes did a story on how this big drug distributor, McKesson, I found this right before we started talking. It said McKesson was shipping the same quantities of opioid pills to small town pharmacies in Colorado's San Luis Valley as it would typically ship to large drugstores next to big city medical centers. It was enough pills to give every man, woman, and child a monthly dose of 30 to 60 tablets. So I am not a sort of drug prohibitionist. I think I think marijuana should be legalized. I think people who get thrown in prison for decades because of involvement in the drug trade, I think that's a mistake. But man, I really think the government needs to exercise oversight to keep companies from making money on the sale of these horrific drugs like pain pills, right? Like the Sackler family. I mean, it took years for us to understand what was going on with the opioid epidemic. But no, there's a rightful war on that kind of drug. And, more broadly, it opened my eyes. Well, yes, of course, all the ways that heroin, opioids, fentanyl most recently, though it's only just getting to the valley now. But those are terribly destructive drugs. But, you know, then you've got alcohol. There's so many people who drink too much in the world generally. But I think out on the prairie, that can be a response to loneliness is drinking. And I've become more aware of that than ever before. And simultaneously less interested in drinking myself as I get tired of talking to people who've had too much. Over the months, you just think, oh gosh, again, here we are. And then also, I was surprised out there just by the people with real conservative politics who are big potheads. I didn't expect to find, you know, guys carrying their guns on their hips in holsters and with their MAGA hats on, just smoking a lot of weed. I was naive that way. I've got one neighbor who's trying to cure his cancer through THC enemas, and he's as conservative a person as you'll meet. It would be hard to have imagined I would find all these things.
Yeah, it was funny. Every time you try to pin somebody down, they would surprise you in these interesting ways. So let's go back in time a little. You, in the middle of the book, you go into the history of how the flats were subdivided in the 70s and who actually came up with the idea of selling these 5-acre parcels, right? So you quote this fellow named Chet Choman, who made some money selling these. And he said, quote, "There was a mystique about owning a piece of Colorado that kind of lends itself to people from outside the area." And so I love this. And he also says, "A 5-acre parcel was worth a lot more in Chicago than it was in the Valley." So I'm reading that, and all I can think of is Glengarry Glen Ross, the play by David Mamet, selling this real Rancho estate. So we're just going to sell it out there. So I think that's an overall theme of the book, right? Can you talk about this idea that the land is often worth more in people's imaginations than in the real world?
Yeah. So these subdivisions in the 70s, they sold 5-acre lots by mail. Through newspaper ads, TV guys.
You show the ad in the book. There's a replicate. It's so funny to see the actual ad.
Right? Buy your Colorado ranch. And they call this thing a ranch, this 5 acres of prairie that has, you know, there's, I don't know how you could be a rancher there unless you had a creek running through it or something. There's no utilities. There's no water. There's no electricity. And, but people, you know, owning land is a big deal. It taps into something deep in our psyches. And the terms that these subdividers came up with at the time were like the only way you could buy land without a down payment in the United States. And there was, $30 or $50 down payment and then $30 or $50 a month. Even a person of very modest means could say they own land in Colorado. And I'm going out there this summer. And it sounds so scammy. And in one way it is, because you won't be able to sell this for what you paid. Right. Which I guess that's the definition of a scam. It's a bad investment in terms of making money, but can you have an investment that's good in terms of how it makes you feel? And I think if you can, then maybe you understand why Chet Choman, who you quoted, does not feel guilt about selling these lots. The Federal Trade Commission did a big investigation of these real estate companies that sold these lots and insisted they pay a fine and refund money to all these people who then did not want their money back.
Yeah, they didn't want it back. Yeah.
They were happy with what they got. And so that was a bit of an eye-opener to me too, that just like you say, there's sometimes it's you'll pay for the mystique and maybe you're not getting ripped off.
Yeah. They sell that. I just heard last week and I made me think of your book, you know, you can buy an acre of land in Scotland So you're officially, you know, a lord, you know, you can say, you can have, get your certificate or something in America and hang it in your office wall or something.
Don't do it, Dan. Don't yeah, buy that.
I won't do it. So I want to run, this is my longest question for you, but I want to run this by you because it was my favorite moment in the book. And I think a moment that really epitomizes what you do as a writer so well. So here's what it is. I want to get your reaction to this.
Yeah.
So you tell a story about a guy who comes to La Puente's headquarters in Alamosa, and he wants some snacks, and he's given the person that works there a really hard time. Like, he says, give me some snacks. She says, okay, I just want to enroll you in the system here. And he keeps giving sarcastic answers. You know, he says, my name is Benjamin Franklin. I'm 200 years old. He's being really nasty. A scene is happening. He gets his snacks and he leaves, right? And you say, like, you're fascinated by the calm demeanor of the woman who's taking care of them, right? And you say, well, that's how La Puente works. And this is their motto is, you can't really know their pain, so don't judge. So I get to that part in the book, because I'm getting annoyed too by the guy, right? Mm, and yeah. Then you can't know their, and I'm, okay, right. That's a good check on you, Dan. You can't know his pain, so stop judging. Fair enough. And then in the very next sentence you say, but what about judging? And I'm like, okay, wait a second now. And then I'm like, where is Ted Conover going with this? And then you tell the story of somebody out on the flats who's not in the best shape physically or materially in terms of living shape, who took his $1,400 COVID stimulus check to buy a go-kart. Mm. So he spent that on a go-kart, right? He needs help getting the go-kart in the truck, and you kind of get a little, maybe a little bit on your moral high horse, and you say, no, I disapprove this. I can't believe this is what you're going to spend it on. You disapprove that. But then you kind of say yes. So the reader's going back and forth, kind of like a metronome, right? So I thought that was the best moment in the whole book. I don't know if you thought it was that good when you wrote it, but can you talk about that moment, the go-kart moment, and this idea of judgment and how the reader's meant to approach these people? Because I thought it was great.
So I was taught out there, not just by my neighbors, but by La Puente. And La Puente's mission is to, help people who've had some bad luck. And it's like an article of faith for La Puente that you should not judge them for being homeless, for being addicted, for being abusive. I mean, La Puente really tries to remind everyone who works for it that, you know, you have certain obligations to protect vulnerable people. You know, if you see a crime being committed, you need to respond to that. But if you're trying to figure out how to talk to somebody, you should not do that from a place of judgment, because you don't know what they went through up till now. And that all sounds great until you see your colleague in the food bank being disrespected in this sarcastic way by this guy. She was keeping her calm, but I was losing mine. I was like, I'm ready to go shout at this guy. And she tells me later, you know, I learned when I was a high school teacher, they're just trying to get a reaction, and they're speaking out of their own pain. And clearly he's got mental problems, and I don't take it personally. And I just thought, whoa, I don't know how you do that, because it doesn't feel good to suspend judgment sometimes, right? Sometimes you just, you figure it's who you are as a human being. You have to respond and forcefully to somebody who's misbehaving so badly. But then, yeah, it was in the same month that I had to make the decision about driving this guy into town to buy a go-kart.
A go-kart.
And he lives in a trailer the size of mine with four kids, his wife. They have very little. And, you know, I'm sure including enough warm clothes and nutritious food, and he wants to buy a go-kart. And so reflexively, I'm like, I'm not going to help him do that. But then I thought about it overnight, and I thought, well, that's what he wants. And maybe he knows what he needs. You know, it's a right. La Puente thing. So I went back to tell him I would drive him into town and discovered he'd already gotten a ride. So I didn't have to. But then I spun by the next day, and the whole family is out on the go-kart. And they also bought a mini bike. It was enough money to buy both. And they are having so much fun. And the little girl who's 8 years old runs up to me and said, Mom can't come right now because she's on the go-kart. And it's complicated, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's really complicated. And I wanted to be open that I don't always have the answer. And judging or not judging is, I think, one of the hardest things we do as human beings.
Yeah. And that's what I think, even long apart from Colorado, I think that's one of the great things about your book, because it really is a book about judgment, in which the reader is like exhibit A, and the reader is constantly like I constantly felt myself again being like sucker punched in the best ways, where as soon as I had my mind up made up about somebody, you know, so you find out something else, like you said before about finding out the guy was a sex offender or something else. And that's like true of the whole flats, right?
Thank, I appreciate that you saw that. Thank you.
Sure. So let's move to the beginning and the end. So the epigraph of the book. You have an epigraph. The passage is by Kent Haroff, the Colorado novelist. And here's what he says of the prairie. He says, quote, "It's dry, but it's not an empty place. Never mind what people think. It may not be pretty, but it's beautiful if you know how to look at it." So what did you learn? Like, how do you look at it?
So I guess there's two big things I'm encountering in my book. Part is the natural surrounds, which it's not the alpine Colorado beauty that you associate with John Denver, right? But it's a different beauty, and it's spectacular, but you have to look past the mountains maybe to appreciate it. And then the other subject of my book is all these people. And likewise, if you are in your expensive car driving by the prairie, you know, at a high rate of speed, which you can do there, and you see somebody in a broke down old van, you know, looking like they just came out of Oklahoma in the Dust Bowl, you might think that's not a beautiful sight. But if you got to know them, you might see beauty in them as human beings, as I've got to say, as I did time and again. So that is part of what the challenge to me as a writer, and what I like to think the challenge is to a reader as well, is to think about what's beautiful here.
Yeah, that's the epigraph is, how do you see it? Because it's complicated, right? So if somebody said to me right now, well, what are the people like in this book? I'd say, well, you got to read it. Like my adjectives aren't going to believe me. You just got to read the thing. So let's go to the end of the book, right? The book's last sentences. Here's what you say at the end, quote, "And so I came, saw, and left over and over again. I built a fence because it felt right and because I planned to stay a while longer." So do you still have the trailer in the land?
I do. I can reveal to you today, that's it on the cover of the book. taken by a drone that owned by a friend of mine who came by. I wasn't even there. He said, "Can I go see your place?" And he said, "Yeah." And he took that picture. And so it's funny, you know, my other projects, especially New Jack, where I was a corrections officer, I was so relieved when that job was over. Right. And when I finally finished writing the book, I just felt a huge weight was off my shoulders. I'm always, I guess, happy to finish a book, but in this case, I'm not happy to finish the research because I still like it out there. It's grown on me, and I'm going to keep going. I've been four times since I finished writing the book, and I hope I will go that many times next year. I'm not sure if I'm supposed to become friends with my subjects, but I'm something friendly out there, and I'm a neighbor, maybe put it that way. And I like going there. So, and it's every time there's something interesting that I would never have imagined in my other life. So it's been a project I am glad to have jumped into, and I have one foot still there.
Have any of the people you've written about read the book?
Yeah, I'd say most probably have, because I sent my first advance copies to them. I figured I owed that to them. If the world's going to be able to read about them, they should be able to first. And I'd already done all this fact checking, so they knew what I was writing about. And in most cases, they knew exactly what I had said. And, you know, I think a couple have basically said, well, I wouldn't have put it quite the way you did, but the way you put it is true. And I take that as a good sign, right? They're not going to disavow me or disavow the book, but they might put it their own way, as everybody has the right to do.
Right. Is there anything on the horizon for you now, or are you taking a breather, or do you know what your next immersion project is going to be, or you don't want to talk about it? Or
I don't know that I've ever known what the next one is going to be until the last one receded a little bit and left some space in my brain for new things. I'm still quite full of this book, and happily. So we should talk again in a year or so.
Okay, great. Well, it has been great talking to you today, Ted. This conversation is everything I'd hoped for. I cannot recommend your book highly enough to anybody who's listening to this right now. And you're like, that kind of sounds kind of interesting. I'm telling you, get the book. It's phenomenal. James McBride, the novelist, the cover blurb says, "I hope every American reads this book." And that's not actually hyperbole. I mean, I think it's a book about America and about people in it and how to think about them.
I'm really glad the book found you, Dan. And I appreciate you as a reader. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you so much, Ted.